You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Grant Newsham is not picking up, so we'll stand by for him. He just emailed me, so I know he's there.
The person whom you're trying to reach is currently unavailable. Please leave a message after the beep.
Day's breaking, I ain't waking up, I'm sleeping in. I'm on the road now, I gotta move out this dream. Yeah, if you're just tuning in, we've been listening to... Oh, I think that's Grant Nation. Good morning, Grant. How are you?
All right, thanks.
Well, first of all, welcome to the program. Thanks for doing this again, as always.
Mm-hmm.
We just listened to General Mattis, or Secretary Mattis, in Singapore from last week. One, did you get a chance to see that? Two, if you did, your thoughts on it, and how is he being received? Much is being written about. He is the de facto Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State. So your thoughts on his trip to the Pacific?
I only read the transcript, so I didn't actually hear it. But I spoke with some people who did hear it, and I thought he did a very good job, actually. He said what he was supposed to say. He stood up for U.S. interests in the region, particularly, and he was specific about the South China Sea and the basically the fact that what China is doing there is wrong. He, of course, got across the seriousness of North Korea, and that was not surprising. So overall, he covered the waterfront, and he did very well. In terms of how it's received, it's certainly better than the alternative. So he certainly got things right in terms of what he said. But now it's a question of what does America actually do? So we'll see how that goes. He's in Australia right now, with Secretary Tillerson, meeting with the Australians. And so once again, this is a, we've got an opportunity to succeed. We'll see how that goes. It's worth noting, of course, that the Chinese, of course, took great offense at what he said, particularly challenging them on the South China Sea. Right. And they, as is usually the case when China is faced with an event or a meeting where they cannot dictate what happens, they will send somebody who's very low level, which is what they did. And that person, of course, afterward expressed his great offense and that's what General Mattis had said. But that was all predictable. So he said the right things. It was well received, but there's an expectation to see what the concrete outcome of this is from in terms of what the United States does now.
And just so everybody's familiar, if they're tuning in for the first time, how do you say that? ASEAN? How do you correctly pronounce our partnership in the Pacific?
I would usually say ASEAN.
ASEAN. Okay. What our ASEAN allies are used to, though, is the Americans blustering and then the Chinese doing what they want.
Well, they've gotten used to that. you know, that they've also kind of gotten used to some, even some pretty watered down language in recent years. But you're right, a lot of talk, and then at the same time, China has expanded their control over a good bit of Southeast Asia, both actual and psychological control, which is equally important.
The as a viewer, an analyst, and a commentator on things in the Western Pacific, does their visit set up anything? What is the significance of their visit?
I think that it. The fact that they're coming, and these are a couple of, both Secretary Tillerson and General Mattis are both people who understand the importance of getting things done and the importance of concrete results. And that's unusual. It's not just, it's possible this is not just a nice feel-good sort of let's talk meeting and then go away and leave events to take care of themselves. But the simple fact that he's coming is a good thing, and so soon. And you'll notice that this is taking place as there's always been already been a lot of official attention to the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia, Israel, even Europe's gotten a lot of attention. And so it's good that Asia itself is getting some firsthand. Visits by really a couple of the most important U.S. officials there are. So this, once again, we'll see how that goes. And if Mr. Trump actually does go down to Southeast Asia later in the year, that would be an even bigger deal. So once again, it's a first step, as I would see it, with this new administration and Asia. And we'll see how it goes.
All right, it's a first step, and they will be judging us. I think the most interesting, certainly his speech, the questions in his speech would, you know, what would he be direct relative to China? And it's hard, I think, he almost blows a gasket when he can't be direct, and some things he wasn't. But relative to China, he was relatively direct. Is that what the jury sits there and wants to see? And by far the more interesting part of the speech was the Q&A after the speech. So and that was very interesting. He got asked very pointed questions. They somehow or other consolidated the questions. And I don't think that the answer to, certainly to some of the things that they asked, he didn't give them great answers to it. But I thought it was interesting. Does this set up anything in the future? Right, again, are we just looking at the first overtures of the Trump administration? And it is very interesting because I think he's looked at as the most stable, and the best thing in the Trump administration is the stewardship of Secretary Mattis over our military relationships that are so significant in the world right now.
I think that's right, that he's well-regarded. And this was his first time. Well, he'd been up in Northeast Asia and did well with the Japanese and the Koreans, but this was his first time down in Southeast Asia. And you're right that, one, the way they asked the questions in the at the event was an awkward way because they combined a number of them at once, and then he has to try and give an answer which responds well to everybody. And I think the last person that could do that, I'm told, was George Marshall when he was chief of staff in World War II. He answered pretty well, though, as you said, he was speaking elliptically in a lot of cases. But really what matters is what is going to be done with Chinese aggression in Southeast Asia. And that's what people are most worried about in that audience. Northeast Asia is a little bit different, but unfortunately, the U.S. approach towards North Korea and China's alleged role in solving that problem is going to have an effect on what happens in Southeast Asia.
If you would, a brief synopsis of where we are in the South China Sea is that, and you can be sure to correct me if I'm wrong, is the Chinese, I like General Tulin's explanation of, he says, look, they perceive the Pacific the Western Pacific is their domain. We have a line stretching from Korea through Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines to Australia. We have contained them. They are attempting to break that containment. What they're doing in the South China Sea is a first step, and so they have gone and militarized islands in the South China Sea. The Philippines, Vietnam, I don't know who else was a part of it, but went to the International Court of The Hague, and that court ruled in their favor that China has no standing or legal right to those islands. And that, then blustering post-decision by the International Court of The Hague, and yet that is where we stand today with blustering and the Chinese building. Is that did I miss anything there? Is that the current state of affairs?
That's the current state. The Chinese have gradually asserted their influence over the South China Sea, not just influence, their control. And they've also had some success with some of the countries that surround the South China Sea in winning them over and sort of subverting them politically. And they, I say, just it continues gradually and really without very much to stop it. And the U.S. is really the only party that can do that. Ideally, working with a few allies. One thing we would challenge on this, or suggest a different look at the characterization of the United States containing China. We're not containing China. If we were going to do that, China would know it. Now, we know how to contain people. What we have is a presence in East Asia that happens to be along that what is called that first island chain from Korea down to Indonesia.
Right.
And we've been there for 60, 70 years in most cases. And we're really not doing anything that much different than we've ever done in Asia. But what you have is an aggressive China which wants territory. It wants maritime territory. And it is claiming that because of the U.S. presence that it is being contained. But I would suggest that as we know how to contain China if we wanted to, and we've never done anything of the sort. And one might compare this to, say, you've got the New York Police Department, which has been in place for an awfully long time, and it does whatever it does. And 99.9% of the people in New York are very happy with that. And then suppose you got a very powerful mafia group that wanted control of New York. And so it started to complain that it was being contained by NYPD. So it really, depends on your point of view. And I would suggest that something similar exists in East Asia that China can call it containment. And that's a good excuse. It's sort of a psychological, political tool or point of leverage from which to sort of make sort of confuse people. More than anything, but that is really just an excuse for China wanting a good chunk of territory in East Asia. But once again, just a characterization of it. But otherwise, the general's, I think, is quite correct.
My guest this morning, and gracious to get up early to do this, is Grant Newsham. So what is the time difference now? Is 5 hours, not six?
It's only, I'm in the U.S. now.
Ah!
So it's only 3 hours.
There you go. All right. Well, that's good. I thought I was imposing on your sleep again. All right. Grant wrote an article here recently, and it's entitled U.S. Marines and Okinawa, Enough Exasperation to Go Around. This exasperation has been going on forever. So talk to us how, first of all, you can find the article. It is in Asia Times. If you go to All Marine Radio's Facebook page or Twitter, you'll find it there. So, Grant, what is the issue? The Marine Corps obviously changing its posture, evolving its presence to include Guam. And yet we still, I can remember as a second lieutenant in 1985 when I deployed to Okinawa with 1st Battalion, 5th Marines. We had one of the M60 tanks, and they could fire at Camp Hansen into a concrete bunker on the side of a mountain, and that was all that they could do. There was no other operating on the island. They had a track that they could drive around. And so, and then I'll never forget, we're out shooting, getting ready for some dog and pony show that we were doing. And so my platoon was doing a dog and pony show. We had to low crawl through the dirt. We had to employ the saw, which was a new weapon at that point in time. And we started a fire in an impact area. And, so we go into a check fire. We tell range control, a warrant officer, and I want to say a staff sergeant come out. Out of their truck, they grab kind of shovel-looking type things, except instead of metal, it was rubber. And they went into the impact area that we had been shooting M203 rounds into and machine gun ammunition into, and they start tamping out the fire. So I'm a second lieutenant. I look at my company commander, and I said, is that smart to be tamping out the fire in an impact zone like that? And he said, I don't know. They must know what they were doing. And with that, an explosion. And the staff sergeant goes down, and I looked at him, and he says, go out there and get him. They wind up landing a 46 in the impact area, and we get him on there. And I just remember thinking, like, what am I walking on? And then the rationale was, no, when fires start out there, the reason they had to go out there was we had to pay the Japanese for crop acres that we destroy by fire, and that still is part of the lease. I said, oh. And so this is 1985. This has been going on forever. Bring us up to the current state, and then where are we right now?
Okay, well, the U.S. Marines and other services as well, but the Marines have to really get the most attention, have bases on Okinawa. And the bases are there to conduct operations in Asia that also include defending Japan. So Japan gets something out of these bases. Now, for a long, long time, and you noticed it when you were there, there has been a sort of there's been some opposition to the bases in Okinawa. That's to be understood. The U.S. is all the Americans want to do is to just be able to operate from Okinawa as we are allowed to do by the U.S.-Japan Defense Treaty, and in fact, as the Japanese tell us they want us to do. But the Americans have had to deal with varying degrees of local opposition on Okinawa. Sometimes it's vocal and sometimes it's sort of not so much. And that's what the Americans want to do, and they have to deal with this opposition. And yet you've got considering the situation, it's the Americans are the visitors, the Japanese are the hosts, and you would think it would be the Japanese responsibility to ensure an environment, to take care of the opposition, so that the Americans can operate without this constant criticism and constant opposition. And the Japanese central government has simply never done what it needs to do. The main case in point is the Futenma Air Station, which everyone who's been to Okinawa knows about.
Of course.
The Marine Corps Air Station. And it's now in very heavily populated territory. The city grew up around it because Japan, one, has no zoning laws, really, and Japanese authorities did nothing to keep a buffer around the air station. So it's really in the middle of a city, basically. And the Americans agreed to move the facility if they could find a decent location. And this was pretty much agreed to about 20 years ago. And you heard 20 years ago. So it still hasn't moved. The Japanese government just a few months ago started some of the initial work to build a replacement facility in a place called Henoko in the quieter part of the island. So one could have joined, and the Japanese promised at least five times that I know of that this time they would build it, this time they would keep their promise, and they never did. So one could have joined the Marines 20 years ago when the Japanese first promised to build this air station and retire today, and the air station is still not built. And they say that's just an example of how the central government has not been willing to spend the political capital to take on sort of a noisy Okinawan opposition. The last thing I'll say is you can kind of, before I give you some a chance to respond, is that it's sort of the equivalent here of the mayor of Oceanside telling the U.S. Congress and the whatever administration it is how the Marines are going to be deployed in Asia or in Western, in anywhere. So you have the, basically the mayor or the governor has this disproportionate influence on national Japan's national security or the national security of the country. And instead of just being told, no, be quiet, the Japanese central government rolls over, just cowers, and says, well, we can't do anything. It's the Americans who are to blame. So it's been allowed to turn – it's been a serious sort of troublesome problem for a long time, but it just appears impossible to solve given the spinelessness to go around on all sides.
I guess the question would be why, Grant? What, I mean, Okinawa, is it a hot-button issue that will resonate politically on mainland Japan? Why not? And do you expect there'll be movement given the increased value that security agreement has, and now that North Korea is doing however we would categorize what they're doing, saber rattling, ICBM rattling, whatever they're rattling these days?
You would think so, that this would sort of wake people up and have them do whatever's necessary to preserve the Marine presence. But they haven't really, I don't think anything will change much in the Japanese thinking until a couple of North Korean missiles smack down in Tokyo or Osaka.
Really? Well, it would take that?
I've come to that conclusion. That
you are a bit of a doom. You are a bit of a doom and gloomster. You don't put any stock that the Japanese will do what they do. You don't put any stock that the Chinese will help with Korea, in spite of Mattis's protest otherwise, in spite of the president's protest otherwise. You're pretty staunch in your views. I'm noticing.
No, well, I don't think the Chinese are going to be of any help with North Korea. We'll be disappointed, as we usually are. But I do think when it comes to the Japanese behavior, that it really requires a huge shock, that logic doesn't make any sense. And why we've kind of got to where we are in Okinawa is that part of the reason is that one of the great motivators in Japan is they hate being Japanese, that governments in particular, and Japanese in general, they just hate being criticized. But take the government, and they just hate it. So when this noisy Okinawan opposition criticizes them, they just want it to go away. So the easiest thing to do is to try to buy off the Okinawans, to put the blame on the Americans, and then ask the American government, well, just help us out. You know, please, we've got an election coming. We have to make sure the Okinawans are happy. And implicitly after this election, we'll do what's necessary. Well, there's always an election coming. And unfortunately, there's always the Americans who've been gullible enough to say, okay, we'll help you out just this one time. But there's been just this one time for over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so nothing much has changed. Also, from the United States side, it has not done what it needs to do to apply pressure on the Japanese government to take care of Okinawa so that we can operate there without this harassment, which I think potentially undercuts the entire U.S. relationship if one thinks about it. And then the U.S. Marine Corps has, with some exceptions, has done a very poor job of defending its presence in terms of why it's necessary, building support within Japanese communities on Okinawa and on the mainland, and really explaining why it's there. But as I say, building the political support, the Marines have tended, except for a short period of about 5 years when a fellow named Dr. Robert Eldridge was working on Okinawa for the Marines, the Marines have really just sat back whilst they get hammered by the opposition, by the criticism, and you have a position where if you asked the typical Japanese politician and even the typical Japanese official, why are the Marines on Okinawa? Why are they necessary? 9 times out of 10, they could not give a coherent answer, even in Japanese. So there's been a sort of plenty of neglect and I think malfeasance on all sides when it comes to what's happened on Okinawa. But it really is that fear of being criticized and fear of embarrassment that an anthropologist will explain to you that, and how it's important with the Japanese. And if we're not going to criticize, you know, they're not afraid of us, then they'll just take the path of least resistance to placate the Okinawans, and they pay huge, huge bribes, basically, that still don't placate the Okinawans.
I don't understand. Is it mainland Japanese apathy? Why, after so long, is there no movements? And why is the Marine Corps put in a position where the Marine Corps has got to justify its existence? You know, we just do windows at the end of the day. You know, you don't want us here, there's no treaty, then we'll go someplace else. Why is the Marine Corps in that position to validate itself? And I still don't see the Japanese. If it's not a sentiment on mainland Japan, I would think it wouldn't play. They don't care about the Ryukyus. They never have historically. So I guess I'm a little bit confused. Can you help me out on any of that?
The mainland Japanese, they do see the Okinawans as a little different, but they still see them as Japanese and they see Okinawa as Japan. But in terms of a person's daily life and what they have to do to survive and have a decent life, when they ask the questions on mainland Japan in the surveys, what are you most worried about? Okinawa is not even in the top 10 or the top 20. It's just not something most mainland Japanese care about. It's right. So it isn't the issue that the central government claims that it is. Although that's the impression they give, and it's what they say to the Americans, is that, oh, we have to be so careful here. But most Japanese, and that's, don't care. And the Okinawan population is less than 1% of the Japanese population. So once again, you have this situation of the mayor of Oceanside dictating policy back in Washington, D.C., and that's crazy. It doesn't have to be like that, but for some reason, the U.S. side, and particularly State Department and Department of Defense, have never been willing to make it clear what's needed here. And there's been a sense that the Marines are even the sacrificial pawn or the thing that you can give away to solve the larger problem, to save the larger U.S.-Japan relationship. In terms of what the Marines could have been doing, you know, I think that the Marines should have been doing much, much more than just sitting and doing what they're told and saying, well, it's somebody else's problem. And that's been part of the problem, is because if nobody else in the U.S. government will make your case, then it's something the Marines need to do. They haven't done it, as I said, except for that short period of 5 years or so. When they had the right person down there doing the job, and the right, and a couple other times they've made some efforts, but by and large there has been this idea that it's somebody else's problem, and yet since nobody else is taking care of it, that the Marines have done the equivalent of sitting on the ropes whilst Mike Tyson hits them with roundhouses repeatedly, but just on the grounds that, well, punching back isn't our thing. But it really would take very little effort for the Marines to defend their position. And if it is a position worth defending, they should do it. And Okinawa's benefit, once again, is like real estate. It's location, location, location. But it's a very good place from which to operate in the Pacific. And there's not a whole lot of alternatives to that at the moment, barring some real changes. In fact, if Okinawa were to float 1,000 miles off to the east, All the problems would go away because it wouldn't be all that interesting. It wouldn't be all that useful at that point.
We have to take a break. When we come back, can you update us on the whole marine migration around the Pacific? I've got an email here, and so I'll read it to you. Mac, would Grant be so kind as to update us on where we're at relative to Australia and our migration, it seems like, off and on to Guam? So when we come back, can you update us on what we're doing in the Pacific?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. All right. My guest this morning, Grant Newsham here in the United States, of all places. And he joins us. We're talking about things relative to the Pacific Rim, in particular the issues relative to the United States Marine Corps presence, in particular training presence on the island of Okinawa, which is a controversy that is not strange to any of us. So it's been going on for a long time. More of All Marine Radio coming up. No, more of All Marine Radio coming up next here on a Monday edition, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer, but I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our way of living, our quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines. All you Mustangs, listen up. The Marine Corps Mustang Association is comprised of Marine Corps officers and officers.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Ten 10:45 on a Monday. All Marine Radio continues. Grant Newsham joining us. Grant, where in the United States are you? What are you doing?
I'm back in Hawaii right now.
Well, that's still early, you know. What the hell? I thought you were mainlanding.
Oh, but, no. I'm still good and early here.
All right. Well, then I do appreciate your getting up early. Tell everybody, do you write on a regular basis for Asia Times? Okay. All right. So, and they can find that at atimes.com. So very easy. So in the Lux kind of times that you go to, throw A Times in there, and you'll see Grant's work on a regular basis. Before the break, you were going to update us relative to Australia, Guam, and Okinawa. Where in God's name are we relative to all of that? So go ahead.
Okay, well, first, a little history is helpful. There's a move afoot, and it's a plan, I think, to actually move Marines from Okinawa and split them up throughout the Asia-Pacific. And specifically, roughly, it would call for moving about 5,000 Marines, I think, back to Hawaii, about 4,000 or so to Guam, and then to also put about 2,500 in Australia, up in northern Australia, in Darwin. So this is the idea being that by doing this, it, quote, reduces the burden on Okinawa, unquote, and it makes the opposition go away on Okinawa. Now, the origins for this plan, which few people seem to remember these days, they go back to about 2003. When Donald Rumsfeld, then Secretary of State, visited Okinawa, and he met with the governor and some other local officials. And the American officials advised him not to meet with these people because it wasn't appropriate for a Secretary of State to meet with them any more than it would be a Minister of Defense to meet with the mayor of Oceanside. But he did anyway. And predictably, the Okinawans offended him. They were rude to. They were as usual. They complained a lot. Were very rude. Rumsfeld didn't like that, so he said, "Okay, if you don't want us here, we'll move. We don't want to be where we're not wanted." And as a result, that sent all his the minions, all the toadies, and all his staff. It sent them scurrying to figure out a way to move. And that was the origin of it. It wasn't as if there was a carefully thought-out assessment of U.S. and Marine security requirements in Asia-Pacific and then a decision made to move people to certain places. It was simply because Rumsfeld took offense at his visit to Okinawa. So as a result, ever since then, there's been this move to split up the Marines, to move them throughout the region, all intended to placate what is seen as sort of too serious Okinawan opposition. And so this is what comes of making defense policy based on taking offense or taking umbrage. And I would suggest that in terms of resolving Okinawan opposition to the Marine presence, moving these Marines is not going to make much difference. I'd compare this to moving your living room furniture around at, say, a wife's orders. You can spend any length of time moving the furniture around, and it's really not going to make anybody completely happy forever. But anyway, that's where we are. And this is all supposedly going to take place it was supposed to be done already, but it isn't, of course. It might take place within a decade or so. Once again, if you join the Marines today, I'm not sure you wouldn't retire before it's brought to fruition.
Today?
I'm afraid so. Things seem to take a while, even for us. But going down the locations, everybody knows Hawaii.
Right.
They also know just how far away from the action it is, from the key terrain in East Asia.
Right.
So you move 5,000 troops there, Marines there, and that's a long ways away. Guam is another case, and Guam has been one hardly knows what to say. It has not been brought to fruition, mostly because on the U.S. side, government level, military level, there's really been a lack of prioritization. There was an agreement to move to Guam, but then nobody really did all that much of anything. And one of the problems that we've got now on Guam is that part of the move was to have something called, was to have an amphibious combined arms training area up on an island called Pagan at the northern end of the Marianas chain. And it's uninhabited, and it's where you could do some very good combined arms amphibious training, and you could invite other countries' militaries in as well. As a lot of Japanese could come down all the time instead of driving to San Diego. And unfortunately, that the Chinese have been able to insert themselves into the Guam, Saipan, Northern Marianas environment, basically promising resort and investment development, tourism development, but with the implicit requirement that the military buildup not take place. And the U.S. has not responded to this well, and as a result, a certain amount of opposition has developed locally, particularly in Saipan and the Northern Marianas, opposing the U.S. presence and sparked by Chinese subversion, call it what you will, and that's where we are. So this amphibious training area has not moved along in terms of being developed. The development on Guam itself, which is a more welcoming environment, that's progressed to a certain degree. But once again, it all seems to suffer from a lack of seriousness at the really at the U.S. national government level in Washington. The Guam just isn't seen as all that important. So there hasn't been much effort to really to force this to come to fruition. But there is still a plan to move Marines to Guam. And then there's also the 2,500 Marines that could eventually be in Darwin, Northern Australia, which is a very good place from which to assert U.S. influence in Southeast Asia. Well, you could very nicely operate MUs out of there. You could do all sorts of training with partners and potential partners down in Southeast Asia. It's a perfect location, which we don't have, and that is in addition to the benefits for the U.S.-Australia relationship. But what's come from a Marine Corps perspective, as I understand it, is they've run afoul of, in addition to just the sheer slothfulness and malfeasance or that's gone into moving people, there's a financial problem, and there's it costs some money to make these moves and to operate Marines there. And the Marines aren't getting much help with it. And so that's, as I say, is causing the Marines considerable difficulty right now is figuring how they're going to pay for all this, even though it's been agreed that it's going to be done. And so it's, I don't know if in limbo is the right word, but there's certainly a lot of hesitance and certainly on the U.S. side, and it's not as if people are, so it's not as if anyone is saying full speed ahead, this is what we're going to do. There's just been a lot of friction and inertia that's worked into all of this. So there's a plan. When it's actually going to take place, I'm not sure. This is not going to solve any problems with Okinawa, but there is actually sort of a silver lining to this. I think if it's done with enough imagination, that what you can do potentially by moving Marines around, say if you do it right, is you've added some strategic depth to the position in a U.S. position in Asia, or the Marine Corps position in particular, is instead of being based on entirely on mostly on Okinawa, or on a line stretching from mainland Japan down to the Philippines, you've added some depth. If you look at where Guam is,
right.
Put Marines in Australia, use them properly, and you've changed the dynamic, particularly from the Chinese perspective. So there is actually some good things to this. Sending 5,000 Marines to Hawaii, I think, is the wrong direction to send them, but that's once again is part of that. Moving the furniture exercise that was originated to placate Donald Rumsfeld, and that's where we are.
You know, I don't need, just so you know, Grant, I don't need any encouragement to hate Don Rumsfeld. So why you would pour gas on the fire today, I'm not exactly sure. What an idiot. You know, and I'll tell you what, and to me, it's quintessentially Rumsfeld in terms of the whole thing's arrogant. I will meet with him in spite of your objections. I was offended. Therefore, we will do something about it. In my opinion, he is a villain in American history now. And I don't know whatever he did that was good or got him to the, I guess at an early age, his snarky arrogance was considered an asset by somebody. But I will tell you that he has been a plague upon this nation and the international community. And I just, I just wanted to share that bit of bile with you.
Okay, well, to me, yeah, I suppose he has competition for that title. I don't perhaps have strong feelings as you do, but maybe I think the ancient Greeks would have recognized a character like this of really considerable intelligence, but like a lot of people, hubris kicks in, right. And when that happens, the goddess Nemesis is never far behind, so. I think that the Greeks would not have been surprised by a character like Donald Rumsfeld, who, just throwing that into for the fair and balanced part of the discussion.
Grant Newsham, I guess, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired, and we were talking about things on the Pacific Rim today. Email, right, Sis? Mac, I'm curious to Colonel Newsham's thoughts relative to this dance we're doing in the Pacific. I don't know why in God's name we would ever leave Okinawa. It just befuddles me. And now hearing his point about Secretary Rumsfeld, I'm sitting here at my desk with an aha moment and thinking it's just a bunch of nonsense. I do think our partnership with the Australians is long overdue and will serve the Marine Corps in good stead as well as extending us south and giving us greater operational reach. My question is this. Would it be prudent to base out of Guam relative to Okinawa simply to give the Chinese room? And I listened to the speech and the girl who asked the question towards the end of his speech was interested in very specific things the United States would do, to include patrolling off Scarborough Shoals, which I became aware of thanks to Colonel Newsham. Does he think that we will take any action in the South China Sea that would be perceived as protecting either the Chinese or the Vietnamese, and his thoughts on our move into Australia? Thanks. Always enjoy him. You have a fan, so congratulations on that deal. Your thoughts on moving to Australia? And then it was an interesting question that he didn't specifically answer in that Q&A. But what's next for the United States? More freedom of navigation? Will that be the extent of it?
Let me see here. First off, before I get down to Australia, I just want to be clear that whilst Secretary Rumsfeld is sort of the proximate cause of splitting up the Marines, as I noted earlier, the Marine Corps itself has done a very poor job of defending its presence. When it has made an effort to do so in Japan, it's been wildly successful, but it appears not to enjoy success in this area, and really is doing next to nothing right now. So it's not just Rumsfeld, but Marine Corps itself deserves some credit for the current situation. Okay. In terms of Guam, yes, that's an excellent location from which to operate. It has been, and I remember reading an account, sort of an article that really said this, basically the same thing, and why Guam's time was come, and that we needed to really build up the place militarily, just from a geographic perspective, and which has operational benefits. And I read this in 1982. It was a Heritage Foundation thing. So that should give you some idea how long this has not been developed as it should. The Navy's, of course, have done better, and the Air Force has a presence. But the Marines have never jumped on this the way that they should. And if you think about it, with an amphibious training area in the middle of the Western Pacific, you could invite anybody you want. You could invite Taiwan, Australia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and they could get there quickly, and you could hold an amphibious rim pack effectively. And that doing those sorts of things has a, there's a psychological and political aspect to it as well. So Guam is in fact a pretty good place to go. And one does have to note, of course, that training areas are limited on Guam. But training areas are limited in a lot of places, and we've dealt with it. You either come fully trained and then find other places to top up your training. But the location and operating from there has a huge, it sends a huge political and, once again, psychological message. And this sort of thing really does matter. And you can see how the Chinese have made an effort to stop us there. And because they recognize the benefit of all of this, of these locations better than we do, it seems. And there's also been a considerable amount of Chinese political warfare and subversion on Okinawa itself to build up and support opposition to the U.S. presence, but also to Japanese control of the islands, claiming that Okinawa and the rest of the Ryukyus are actually Chinese territory. So once again, they understand the benefits of this, of these bases. Going to Australia, you know, I couldn't agree more with the listener that location in Darwin is potentially, it's excellent. And it's not well known that the Marines were able to get in there owing to the efforts, as is usually the case, of a major on the Marfor Pack staff who overcame just an unbelievable amount of opposition from everybody who knew that this was impossible, and they're all superior to him. But he just wouldn't take no for an answer. And he's the guy that actually got the Marines into Darwin. And it is a very good location from which to operate. But it needs to be seen as more than just a really big 29 palms of the Pacific, but rather a location from which, to operate, and most of the operating gets done in peacetime, and if it's done right, that prevents having a wartime, but it allows you to really get up into Southeast Asia and to sort of push this presence and this influence by being there more often, doing more things with more people that has not existed today except for what 31st Mew does and a transiting Mew coming from the West Coast or coming back to the West Coast, these little things that they're able to do. But by being down in Darwin, you can actually do more of this more often. But it's curious that even on the Australian side, there's been what I think one would have to call some nickel and diming over who's going to pay for what. I mean, they've really been arguing over some tiny amounts of money. It's not clear exactly why that Australian opposition has materialized, but it's a good place that would be nice if we could see the value of it. And then if we can't pay for it, then make the case in Washington where whatever the amount of money is absolute peanuts. Make the case with the people who can help us and then find the money somewhere. So a good idea you'd like to think would find some funding, since bad ideas seem to find any amount of funding. That would be a good thing. In terms of what the U.S. might do in the South China Sea to challenge the PRC, time will tell, but I'm not all that optimistic. Partly, we just don't have enough ships to go ships and other hardware to actually go in and establish enough of a presence to take on the Chinese. You know, we can do things, but it has the equivalent. It's the equivalent in some cases of just parting the water temporarily. And then once we're gone, then things close up and you have PRC domination of the South China Sea. But that said, there's still a lot that can be done, and you, even if you might be outmatched, you go in and make it clear that you will operate wherever you want, whenever you want, and you can keep doing that and then apply pressure from other directions. But certainly what we can, would be quite profitable, would really be to build up this U.S.-Japan defense relationship so it potentially could operate down there. And also eventually the Philippines will shift and make use of that strategic terrain. Vietnam is excellent possibilities of what we might do with them. And they're over on the west side of the South China Sea, and they really have an interest in the region and have claims to it that the Chinese have pressured and trying to take. And Indonesia as well, down at the very bottom. That's always it's a tricky place to operate. But you've got some kind of, the geography is favorable for at least getting a pretty serious line or chain around the islands, around the South China Sea. But that requires, I think, a good thought-out plan of operation. And it's not just doing things, which is important, but also there's a sort of a political effort that needs to be made to actually, and the Marines can play a huge role in building up these relations with these countries. Things like assigning liaison officers to these countries with the mission of pushing for amphibious capability development, helping them out with that. Because amphibious capability has no natural constituency in most militaries, so it needs somebody to keep the idea alive and to push it. And that would be, you'd get a disproportionate payback if we just applied a handful of good young officers, the ones who have that magic, that you can put them somewhere and they can influence. People want to be like them. Get the right officers, put them in there, and that would be almost as useful as having another Mew in place in some cases. So there's a lot of opportunity down in Southeast Asia. But in terms of the South China Sea, we've waited along too long, really, to, I'd say, to ensure our control and our sort of our dominance of the area. And now it's a question of holding the line whilst we build up our position elsewhere and make the best of it.
One more, another email for you, Grant. And again, my guest this morning is Grant Newsham. And Mac, I'm curious about the perception of nations in the Pacific Rim relative to the president. One of the questions that was asked, Secretary Mattis, kind of betrayed that sentiment. Could Grant characterize how these nations currently view us? Is it with a bit of standoffishness, waiting to see Mattis, the serious businessman, versus Trump, the bloviator? Is that where we're at? Because there are big stakes, certainly, but our steps in and around Korea, I think, have been solid. So I think one of the things that hopefully we're all learning is the bloviating that emanates from the executive branch has not seeped its way into our actions yet, thankfully. I'm just curious, could Grant give us a perspective from the Far East? Grant, would you care to tackle that?
Yeah, I think that the Mr. Trump, yeah, he's the latest thing on which people can focus. But the unfortunate, and I'd say the difficult situation we've gotten ourselves into in East Asia, and particularly Southeast Asia, that predated Mr. Trump by a long time. Both the Obama administration, the Bush administration allowed the situation to drift and didn't push our interests down there at all. And that's really what created a lot of uncertainty towards America writ large. Even if Mrs. Clinton had won the election, I think we'd probably have the same thoughts, once again, particularly in Southeast Asia, as to what exactly are the Americans going to do to give us a sort of an alternative to Chinese domination. And so but Mr. Trump, being the character he is, he attracts a lot of attention. But I think it's important to think back to where we were before he was elected and the situation down in Southeast Asia, where we had Thailand had shifted quite a lot towards China. The Philippines, you could see that shifting away from us, et cetera, Malaysia as well. And that didn't happen. That's not Mr. Trump's fault. He's the kind of guy you can focus on. And we will see how that goes. Like a lot of countries, it depends on who you talk to. Right. As you can find people in Australia, a lot of them, who just despise the sight of Mr. Trump. And then you find some others who aren't aren't as worked up about it, and you find that throughout the region. So it really comes down to, I think, from a Southeast Asian perspective, it's what America's going to do, not so much what Mr. Trump has got in mind, but really, at the end of the day, what is the United States going to do? And that's sort of how I would see it. And as we talked about earlier, it's what in concrete terms is the United States going to do to give a Southeast Asian nation that is interested in avoiding Chinese domination to give them an alternative? And that's very much in question right now. But there's been some okay early signs, but it's late in the day and the U.S. needs to move fast. In terms of Northeast Asia, I agree about the Korean Peninsula, and I think the new administration has actually done pretty well. But I'm afraid where I've got a real concern is that they have, for want of a better word, appear to have listened to Henry Kissinger. And the idea here is that China can help us solve the North Korea problem. But to do that, we have to accommodate China, we have to placate China, and not push them on anything else, including the South China Sea or anything, because we need their help on North Korea. There isn't a shred of evidence that I can find that the Chinese are willing or even want to help us with North Korea, but because of that, we've tied our hands in some other places, and in particularly in applying pressure on China, particularly economic pressure, where it could actually do us some good elsewhere. And there's been a longstanding belief that the United States needs China's help to solve all sorts of global problems, such as global warming, the Iranians, just about anything. Right. I'm surprised we don't need their support to put in a new highway in between San Diego and San Francisco. I'm joking about that, of course. But haven't, you know, but they've never, where has this help ever proved useful? Would be the right question to ask. So unfortunately, you've got within the Trump administration, as you always, as we always do, there's differing opinions, differing approaches to foreign affairs. And it does seem as though the Kissingerian one has got undue influence at the moment. But there are others who see things more clearly. So that's, I'm a little worried about the Korean Peninsula, if we think that China is going to help us. And the most sort of troubling thing to hear recently is that China is being invited to the RIMPAC exercise in 2018. This, despite everything they have done before this, they're still going to be invited. So it's as if if there's some guy who's beating up all of your friends in your presence, and you still invite him to Easter dinner every year. It's a curious way to do business.
So we I don't know, a month or so ago when you were on, we were talking. You expressed your sentiment relative to the China and helping with North Korea, and we talked about what would it take for China actually to undertake such an endeavor. And you mentioned that the price would be mighty. It's interesting at the conference in Singapore, Secretary Mattis was asked that specific question. And will you guarantee your allies here in the Western Pacific that the South China Sea will not be used as a bargaining chip in North Korea? And he did not answer that question, but that is certainly their greatest fear. Yes, and then because correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like so the Chinese tell Saipan, hey, we'd love to develop resorts there, and we can guarantee you, I would imagine in the negotiation, we will guarantee you X number of people, because we'll put it on this list and we'll make the fares this and you will, but. Is that still looked at by nations in the Western Pacific as a deal with the devil? That if you make the deal with the Chinese, you are saddled. You get the China problem right into your lap. Is that still how that's perceived?
Eventually it is, but unfortunately the way it works is that there's enough bribes paid to enough people in positions of influence and authority that they don't really care. But you do find it plays out over time that it's not as good a thing for the locals as is originally billed. And the South Pacific Islands, this has already played out, where you get the Chinese in there first with money, then with their commercial interests, which push out the local commercial interests. Organized crime follows it, and then eventually the military works its way in. So this has already played out. One, we don't do enough to challenge it. The Australians don't. The New Zealanders don't down in their area. And we don't make an effort also to pay attention to these islands, to these little places that would desperately like our help. But we, for whatever reason, we're busy, or we just don't give them the attention they deserve. And the Chinese, to their credit, are smart enough to spot an opening and take advantage of it.
So Dancing with the Devil, the Tale of the Western Pacific. And again, we've neglected it. It's kind of interesting. The greater of a sense of a picture that I have, courtesy of you, we've neglected it for many administrations. China been allowed really to do what they want. We do essentially drive-bys on islands and freedom of navigation and our presence in the Pacific, with our smaller Navy, is not certainly, what it used to be, or probably what it needs to be. And now, you know, on occasion we want to kind of bluster up and puff our chest out, and it seems like the nations are used to it. How does the South China Sea, final question for you today, look into your crystal ball. I mean, the Hague has already ruled. What other negotiations can take place in the South China Sea to mitigate this, to unwind it, if you will? Or is it simply the fact that China has done what it will do? The best we can do is to somehow or other make sure that they don't expand their current presence. Is that as good as it gets? And then how do you sit down diplomatically and negotiate this? What is the future there?
Well, it's a good question. I would expect that China will continue to lock up control of most of the South China Sea. There's been recent reports that they're putting in an underwater sort of sensor surveillance system that will be very helpful for them. But say they continue just to lock it up. This militarization of islands will continue. The subversion and blandishments towards regional nations, surrounding nations, that will continue. Then they're building more ships, so more aircraft, but they will have, eventually you'll find that they will, the balance between us and them and the other partner nations in the region, you'll find will shift even more, and you'll find the Chinese have more stuff, more places, more often than we do, or that we can possibly have. Plus they can cover a lot of this from long range. With these new islands they've got in the South China Sea, once those are properly militarized, it makes it, they can have pretty good control of a large part of that region, which that maybe can't be helped unless we were to really apply some pressure elsewhere. I think what you can do is hold the line down there, continue to operate in the South China, inside the first island chain, make it clear that if there's problems that it's going to be a huge problem for China. But you have to make that clear that you're willing to bump back, willing to fight back. And then basically build a line of partner nations around, use the geography and hem them into this South China Sea bathtub effectively. And then at the same time apply some real economic pressure against China. And that's where the real money's to be made, is on economic pressure. So it's not just a military-to-military face-off, but it involves all the things that on which China depends and on which it's vulnerable. But we have to do all of this at once. Diplomatically, unless you operate from a position of strength with the Chinese or with just about anyone, you really will have no chance of success at all. And we need to do something to ensure that we're operating from a position of strength. And a good speech now and then is not a position of strength.
What is a final question? Then our allies have watched this and watched this and watched this and watched this. What is left for them?
It'd be good if they did more for themselves. They don't spend, generally speaking, their militaries are underfunded. They're not shaped properly. You know, there's often a very heavy, for example, ground army component to them. They're not able to work together, you know, in any joint way. And there's been a tendency to buy expensive hardware, partly because there's money to be had for certain people in buying expensive hardware. But the partners themselves need to do more. Of course, the U.S. is the decisive player here, but they have to shake themselves off from this notion that, well, the Americans at the end of the day will come save us. The Japanese as well, of all people, still have a pretty high degree of that kind of thinking as well. So if the Japanese still do it, you can imagine how prevalent it is in other parts of the region.
All right, sir. First of all, again, thank you for getting up early. I hope, what's the weather like in Hawaii these days? Nice?
It's been pretty good, yeah. There's no problem. I'm always glad to wake up early here.
What is the weather like in Hawaii these days? Is it spring? Is it fall? Is it summer? Is your weather pattern similar to ours?
I think summer's coming. A visitor wouldn't notice the difference. But it's not too hot yet. I'd say it's in 82 or so, and there's a breeze during the day and it's sunny. But it does rain now and then. But that's generally what it's like. It just gets 10 degrees hotter in the summer and then a few degrees cooler in the winter. So, to say a visitor would never notice the difference.
All right, sir. You have a wonderful week, and we will catch up with you. Thank you for making us smart, as always, Grant. Truly appreciate you coming on the program, and I can tell you have a large number of fans out there, to include a lot of members of my extended family that have brought you up and talked about how much they've learned about the Western Pacific as you have come on. So thank you for your presence here.
Sure, glad to do it anytime.
All right, there you have it. The one and only Grant Newsham here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. You know what, it just seems when you hear Grant talk about our presence in the Western Pacific, and the neglect over the number of years, you just shake your head. And when you look at American foreign policy and the implements of American foreign policy, and you just think, you know what, if we're not willing, you know, are we going to Fortress America? Is that next? You know, so anyway, we'll take a break. More of All Marine Radio. Coming up next, as we start our second year, boom, Deuce, All Marine Radio Deuce. That's right. Don't touch that dial. Gunner's not going to be with us today. He's attending to friends. So we'll check the news headlines. We didn't have a chance to do that as listening to Secretary Mattis's speech earlier in the program. We'll check that. There's a bunch of stuff in the news. I'll update you on that. All that coming, even the weather. Coming up next.